From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is visiting Kenosha, Wisconsin today, despite the mayor and governor urging him not to avoid further inflaming racial tensions. The city is reeling after a white police officer shot the black man Jacob Blake in the back and subsequent protests that turned deadly when a 17-year-old white teen shot three people, killing two, wounding one. He's been charged with homicide. Last night, President Trump spoke of the shooter as a victim, echoing the shooter's lawyer, who says he acted in self-defense. The president also said it was the shooter who was almost killed. Gina Barton is an investigative reporter covering criminal justice issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, what is the mood in Kenosha today?
Even before today, things have been very tense in Kenosha for the past week. And the president deciding to visit now has made a lot of people nervous that things that he says or that his base clashing with people on the other side of the political aisle is going to inflame the tensions.
Well, the president is visiting damaged businesses and he's going to visit with law enforcement. He will more than likely tout law and order. But is there some concern that, you know, armed militia supporters might show up again to support him? And as you said, he might be drawing them into the city.
There is a lot of concern about that. Jacob Blake's family said that they're going to have a peaceful vigil at the scene where he was shot. And so the hope is that things there will remain prayerful and calm. And if some of these armed so-called militia men who have been out on previous nights do decide to come out, they will be in the areas that have been set on fire, damaged, things like that, which the president will be touring today. So maybe the two sides will be able to stay apart.
In different areas. And the 17-year-old shooter has been charged with murder and attempted murder. How's the response to him, you know, the comments about him from President Trump? How's that going over in Kenosha?
It depends on who you talk to. People who are supporters of President Trump are saying it's clear that the shooter acted in self-defense. People who I talked to who were there, who witnessed these shootings, said it was clearly not self-defense. Nobody seems to agree on anything. And I think one of the problems is when you see something on video, you're not seeing the whole context of the situation. And people are going to believe what they want to believe.
But just to clarify, don't we see on video this young man walking up to a, you know, up to protesters with his gun? And I believe he shot one before others try to take the gun away from him. So when President Trump is commenting about how he seemed to be the victim, he'd already shot and killed one person.
That's definitely one of the issues, is it seems that President Trump's comments are coming in after Kyle Rittenhouse has already fatally shot one person. And that is when a group followed him, and I'm told they were trying to disarm him and prevent him from shooting any more civilians.
The president, as we said, is coming to support law enforcement, but there's also a video of the police before the shooting talking with some of these different armed militia members, including Rittenhouse, saying, "We're grateful you guys are here," offering them water. This, again, is before the shooting. And then after the shooting, he appears to walk right by police. He left the state. He went home to Illinois. And Jacob Blake's family is saying this is a clear illustration of two different law enforcements, one for blacks, one for whites. So as the president visits with the police, what's the sense of law enforcement in Kenosha? You know, this seems like a big wound.
It really does. And adding salt to that wound is the fact that President Trump does not plan to meet with Jacob Blake's family. The president said he had talked to their pastor, but the family says they don't have a pastor, so they don't know who he actually talked to, if anyone. So the fact that he is coming here, possibly going to inflame tensions when the governor asked him to reconsider that decision, and that it seems he's only going to be engaging with law enforcement, I think is doing a lot to reinforce the beliefs of Jacob Blake's family and of other Black Lives Matter protesters that the president doesn't care about them.
Gina Barton, investigative reporter covering criminal justice issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to New York City now, where the United Federation of Teachers and Mayor Bill de Blasio have averted a strike over school safety during this pandemic. New York City is the only major city that was attempting to welcome students back to school buildings on schedule. It's pursuing a blended model of both remote learning and in-person instruction. But as part of the deal reached today, students who are supposed to go back to school next week will now resume in-person classes September 21st. Let's bring in Jessica Gold, education reporter for WNYC, for the latest. And Jessica, the United Federation of Teachers, which is New York City's public school teachers union, was weighing a possible strike over school safety. Now they've reached this deal. What more can you tell us about the deal reached?
Sure. So the deal reached is a delay, which is what principals and teachers have been calling for weeks and weeks now. The in-person school is going to start on September 21st instead of September 10th, which was a week from Thursday. And there'll be a couple days of online orientation for students before that. Teachers still have to report to schools as they were going to the day after Labor Day. But this gives them more time to prepare. There's also a new requirement around testing. That was a key point for the union. They really wanted the school system to commit to more stringent testing requirements. The school system had said that they would encourage staff to be tested before school started, but it wasn't a requirement. Now what the agreement has is that there'll be randomized testing of school populations every month, 10 to 20% of the school populations, in addition to the protocols that the Department of Education had already laid out if a student is actually symptomatic. So that's to check whether there's community spread and be a broader protection than just responding to symptomatic cases.
There had also been some other concerns, like ventilation systems. Were there enough cleaning supplies and PPE? How does this deal address some of those concerns?
Yeah, well, principals have been pleading with education officials, with the department, to delay school starting because of this. There are ventilation systems in really, really old school system, really old school buildings all over the city that don't work and haven't worked for years. And they're being told that they'll be fixed by next week, but that's a very short turnaround. Some of them haven't gotten their PPE, so masks and gowns for nurses, thermometers for taking temperatures. There's been concerns about whether there's sufficient cleaning supplies to keep school buildings sanitary. And then there's also a huge problem with staffing because the hybrid model is encouraging teachers to either be remote or in person, which means you basically have to almost double the teaching staff. And principals have just been tearing their hair out trying to figure out how to stretch their staffing to cover both kinds of school. The mayor has said that they're going to dispatch substitutes and even people who work, you know, in the central office with desk jobs who have teaching certificates to be in classrooms. But the principals I talked to yesterday with a next week start date say they don't have the names of who those people are or know anything about them yet.
Yeah. Several surveys I know went home to parents. They're asking what type of model they'd like to see. What's been the consensus among parents?
So about a third, I think it's now more than a third of parents have opted to go fully remote. So keep their kids home and do instruction that way. And they can opt back in quarterly. And then that leaves two thirds of the school systems, parents and families saying that they want to send their kids in. The survey was a little iffy because you only had to sign in to say you definitely wanted to be remote. Otherwise, you were put default into the going in person case. So I'm hearing from principals that they actually have a lot more remote learners than the school system surveys say. But Mayor de Blasio, who has been pushing and pushing and pushing for schools to reopen and reopen on time, points to these numbers and says, look, a vast majority of parents want and need to send their kids to school, and students are so much better served in person than they are remotely. And so that's why he's been beating this drum so much in the past weeks.
You know, with the minute I have or so with you, New York City is the largest school district in the country. What happens there could really impact how other districts decide to move forward. Really quickly, can you give me a sense of the blended model? What exactly that would even look like?
Right. So the idea is that you need to have social distancing in the schools. And in order to do that, you need fewer kids in classrooms, in spaces. So principals have been asked to figure out how many students they can safely fit, and then the other kids will be remote. So there's the population of families who are going all remote, and then other kids will be in school 1 to 3 days a week, depending on how much space there is and how well they can be served. And then they'll be home remote the rest of the time.
That's Jessica Gold, WNYC education reporter, talking to us about New York City's plans to partially resume in-person teaching later this month. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's a census. Yeah, and here's some pictures. Descendants of John Van Der Zee.
Family tree.
In the 1800s, yeah. James Van Der Zee, who was the photographer in the Harlem Renaissance.
And a relative of yours.
Yeah, my grandmother's first cousin.
Yesterday, we met Eleanor Meyer, who showed us the deep research she and a cousin have done on their family history in upstate New York. A black woman raised in Massachusetts, Eleanor's grandmother always told her, of course, there were no slaves in that family history.
She did say that, and it was because there was still, growing up with her, it would be a shame.
But through years of research, Eleanor found out that her grandmother's great-great-grandfather, Thomas, was probably born of rape. His mother, Mary, had grown up in an enslaved family, the Egbertsons. And although Mary was born free in 1801, she joined her family as companion and servant to the children of a white family, the Hoddlings.
The Egbertsons were enslaved by the Hoddlings. Mary Egbertson had gotten pregnant at 13, and from the age 13 to 19, she had 5 children. She had probably been raped. Somebody in the family that held them in bondage.
Oh, just...
You know, it's like, I can't go back and fix it. There's nothing I can do about it, but look at her with wonder that she was able to get, and hope that she did get past it, and, you know, didn't live with nightmares, and was able to, I don't know, get on.
This is hard, emotional, genealogical work, made more so because white people who hold many of the pieces to her puzzle usually decline to talk to her.
They don't want to deal with their families having had slaves in the family. They don't want to deal with possibly having black ancestors.
Well, one woman was different.
Yes, my ancestors did enslave her ancestors.
Deborah Bruno, raised in upstate New York, was also told there were no slaves in her white Dutch ancestry. When she found out indeed there were, she posted information on the Facebook page, I've found my enslaved ancestry. Eleanor responded, and the two are now doing research together. Okay, let's see. Deb, are you there?
I am.
Eleanor, are you there?
I'm here.
I feel like you guys are like a team now, like you ought to take this on the road. Well, they actually have. Eleanor has traveled to Coxsackie, New York with Deborah, where she learned, among other things, that the white family that enslaved hers was called the Hotellings, not the Huttlings. Deborah visits families in Coxsackie as often as she can to research in libraries and historical societies, a wealth of information.
I was at the library doing research on Saturday, and I kept sending Eleanor texts and pictures, and I'm sure I totally overwhelmed her with everything I was sending.
I kept pulling over and going, oh my God, what's this? Oh my God.
For example, I spent some time this week looking at the old church records from the First Reformed Church of Coxsackie, and they were baptizing babies. Then all of a sudden, I came to a section where it would just say, this baby was baptized from an enslaved woman. And that's all you would have. You would have no other information. So to be able to find who these babies were, who were actually baptized in the Dutch Reformed Church, is just kind of makes you crazy to try to figure out, how do you get to that? Who were these babies? Who were these people? What happened to them? We are a team. and we work together and we have the same goal, which is to get to the heart of who these people were.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Deborah, Dutch on one side, Italian on the other, in upstate New York. We've talked. I'm of Dutch descent from upstate New York. I'm sure it never occurred to you that your ancestors enslaved other people. You came across a will of your 5 times great-grandfather. Talk about that.
I really felt, oh, no, it couldn't possibly have been my family because my family was poor. They were poor farmers. You know, I had imagined the South. I had imagined the large plantations of the South. And you can find the actual digitized version of the handwritten wills. And so here is in this beautiful flowery script, the ancestor's will saying, whenever the Lord deigns to take me to him, here's my Negro boy Will who goes to my son, and here's another slave who goes to another person. And the moment that I saw that, I felt as if somebody had punched me in the stomach.
Most people in upstate New York, most Northerners, think, well, this has nothing to do with me.
Right. We thought the South were the racists, the bad guys in the fight. We were the Northerners. We fought the Civil War to end slavery, and we were the abolitionists, and we had this Underground Railroad that we were very proud of, and we got the escaped slaves to Canada. And it turns out that it wasn't quite so simple as that.
Okay, so you start a deep dive. You're trying to find some of the descendants of people that your ancestors had enslaved. You found a group called Coming to the Table. They bring together descendants of the enslavers and descendants of the people enslaved. And they were the ones that directed you to the Facebook page that Eleanor was on. I've traced my enslaved ancestors. What was that like when you heard back from Eleanor?
It really felt as if the universe was giving me a gift to find this woman who was as interested in it as I was.
Or as Eleanor said, your head's exploded.
Yes.
but was there also trepidation, Deborah?
Yes. I was terrified because I thought, why would she want to have anything to do with me? My ancestors enslaved hers. My ancestors did terrible things to her ancestors. What right do I have to reach out to her?
As you know, Mary, who became Mary Vanderzee, lived with the White family, the Hotellings.
Yeah.
You knew already that you had a connection with them. And in all probability, you know, Mary was raped by a Hotelling as young as 13.
She had her first child at age 13.
Yeah. Eleanor, what did you say to Deborah?
This is 150 years ago, whatever. And for people to have some sort of guilt about it is, it's not right. You know, you're not responsible in any way, shape, or form. I was very excited. Usually, trying to connect to white ancestry, as I said, it's like slamming a door shut. Making history on that level more personal, I think that grounds you in where you are today.
Yeah. Well, slavery in early Dutch New York shouldn't be such a surprise. Sojourner Truth was enslaved in a Dutch family in New York. She spoke Dutch before she was freed. Now, Eleanor's family may have had shame, but Deborah, did your white ancestors just forget with time?
I think the erasure was much more deliberate. It didn't fit into the narrative of who we were as New Yorkers. If you had an ancestor who fought in the Revolutionary War, as I did, or an ancestor who fought in the War of 1812, as I did, those were the stories that were told. You know, if you find a 1790 census and you find that your ancestor has checked off, yes, I have 6 slaves, that doesn't enter into that pride.
Why are you so invested in this?
This is my job. This is the reckoning that I can do to tell this story. I have to tell this story. And Eleanor has to help me tell this story. It does carry through to racism today. This kind of sense of white people being separate from black people is absolutely a flaw in our way of thinking. And we have to kind of imagine that we are both complicit in this and we bear a responsibility.
These families were living side by side. Mary had, I believe, 4 or 5 children. These children grew up in that area and they were related to the cousins of the white family. They were cousins, they were half brothers, half sisters, but they all lived in this little community together, and I'm sure people knew who the father was. Mm-hmm. And what kind of a dynamic must that have been?
what I'm hearing you say, Eleanor, is that a lot of people knew. And so a lot of people erased this history. Has this changed you both?
For me, it has changed me, absolutely. I don't feel guilty. I do feel a weight of responsibility. I didn't know that I would find this ugly truth and that then I would find a woman who was part of that story that would help me learn even more and who has a wealth of understanding about this that I didn't. So I had a great education just talking to Eleanor. I think about everything differently now. I think about the 100th anniversary of suffrage for women. And I'm thinking, well, suffrage for white women, you know, so it's changed my perspective on everything.
Yeah. Eleanor?
I feel grateful that she opened the door and after the door had, you know, it's been very hard to chip away and get into the other side of this. And what she is doing is getting to the other side of this. And I don't think she realized how wonderful that is, that finally someone from the other side, not open the door, she's kicked the door open and said, okay, people, you've got to look at this. I mean, in the whatever years I've been doing this, this is the first time that's happened. I'm so grateful that she's done that.
Mm. We're part of this family tree that the branches intertwine, and it's so complicated that I'm not sure we'll ever be able to straighten out those branches, but we're trying.
Thank you so much for talking to us about it, all the resources that you used. I think this is going to be so valuable to people who want to do this. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
Eleanor Meyer and Deborah Bruno for part one of our conversation for A Picture of Ancestor Mary Van Der Zee, and for those resources, do your own search. We'll get them to hearandnow.org.
Russia is reporting more than 4,700 new coronavirus cases today, the total number now surpassing 1 million. Only the U.S., Brazil, and India have more COVID-19 infections. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us now from Moscow via Skype. And Sarah, with this milestone, Russia now having more than 1 million cases, is COVID-19 surging there? Is this an indication of a new wave?
No, I don't think so. According to the official numbers, at least the increase in cases has been fairly steady. There's been something like 4,000 to 5,000 cases a day across the country for the past couple of weeks. Judging by anecdotal evidence from hospitals here, I wouldn't say that those statistics are way out of line with reality. At the moment, I think what we're seeing is a steady progression. Don't forget, this is a huge country, the population, something like 140 million. And Russia tends to stress the positive in this. It certainly isn't underlining the 1 million mark here in the state TV news bulletins today.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, there's a question of whether these COVID-19 deaths in particular are being undercounted. It's less than 20,000.
It's pretty clear that the actual number of people who have COVID-19 and who die is much higher than the official tally. But of course, Russia's argument is that not all of them die because of COVID. Some of them had other illnesses and they simply were COVID positive. But others, of course, accuse Russia of manipulating the statistics. And there certainly is a desire here, I think, to paint this as positively as possible, to show Russia as tackling the virus better than other countries. There's a lot of comparison that's done here by officials and in the state media saying that Russia has managed this better than other countries.
What's the status of the vaccine announced by Russian authorities last month? There was lots of skepticism about that.
Well, yes, and I think very well placed. It's a lot of propaganda, I would say, up until now. But the real, you know, the vaccine does exist and it has been tested. And in early preliminary results, it has proved to be effective, although those results and those tests have been small so far. Now we're moving to the bigger phase. I think what's interesting, though, is also the sort of degree of skepticism that there is amongst Russian people here, because some of the opinion polls that have been done, independent polling that's been done of people, has shown that quite a lot of Russians don't actually want to get this vaccine themselves just now yet either.
Also, there's schools opening this week. What precautions are being taken for students? Are they required to wear masks?
Lots of precautions. I mean, I've just been to a school this morning, and in Russia, the 1st of September is always a huge day. It's a really big celebration. Ever since Soviet times, there's lots of singing and dancing and celebration, and people take flowers to the teachers, and they take balloons, and it's a really big day. But today, whilst the schools were trying to sort of have a normal 1st of September, they were also having to bear in mind the pandemic. There wasn't a huge amount of social distancing taking place that I saw. The parents had face masks. The children don't wear masks in school, not even the teenagers. Oh. It's all voluntary. But there is things like, for example, the classes, instead of children moving between classes, the teachers move between the classrooms. So there's less movement around the school. There's antiseptic wipe there, the hand sanitizer and all of that kind of thing. And also all the teachers, every member of staff, in fact, in the school that in all schools in Moscow and colleges, they all had to have COVID-19 tests before the beginning of the school year. So the teachers we know don't have COVID-19, and they're hoping that the children won't spread it because of the measures that they're putting in place. But I have to say it was fairly chaotic even today.
Mm-hmm. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg says it was a mistake not to take down a militia group's page calling on people to bring guns to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where a 17-year-old is charged with killing two protesters. This case has renewed questions about Facebook's rules against inciting violence, especially since it comes just 1 week after the site announced a new ban against militia groups. Let's bring in Elizabeth DeWaskin. She is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks, Tanya.
So, Elizabeth, Facebook eventually removed the group in question called Kenosha Guard. And the event page it posted several hours after the shooting, but the event associated with the group has been flagged by Facebook users at least 455 times. That's according to BuzzFeed News. What has Facebook said about why they allowed it to stay up so long?
Well, Tanya, I have to say that I found this news that this page, Kenosha Guard, had been flagged like 455 times to be really just devastating. You know, you can't ignore it. Those were hundreds of people in Kenosha and elsewhere saying this group looks like a violent group. What Mark Zuckerberg said at the company town hall last week, where he was asked about it, is he just said it was a mistake. And it's like one of those things where when they had privacy violations and they would just say, sorry, it was a mistake, we'll do better next time. But that's just an egregious mistake. You know, this was what came after a week after they had just announced a new policy saying they were banning these groups. So it's just an abject failure of the policy.
Exactly. So Zuckerberg says that it was a mistake. But as you said, just a week before, Facebook banned U.S.-based militia groups and pages that advocate for violence on its platform. There have been calls for Facebook to take down these types of pages for years. What is Facebook doing now as a result of this new policy that it wasn't doing before when there were calls for them to take down these types of pages?
Well, there have been militia groups on Facebook for years, and particularly in the last few years, as there's been this kind of virulent rhetoric around immigration in our country, you see militia groups that have been supporting Border Patrol, that's been written about. And then earlier this year, when the pandemic first started and there were a lot of statewide lockdown orders, and the whole reopen movement kind of surged up on Facebook. And that's when you saw a lot of these militia groups. And, you know, I think Facebook viewed these groups as peaceful protesting groups. But the reality is that there were lots of us, including myself, who were pointing out groups like the Boogaloo that were openly calling for violence or using very thinly veiled terms for violence. And it was only when some, you know, self-proclaimed members of those movements actually showed up at protests with weapons and were arrested that Facebook said, oh, okay, actually, maybe these groups do have a penchant for violence or they're inciting violence. Mm-hmm. What Facebook is doing, they're outsourcing a lot of these decisions still to third-party contractor content moderators. A lot of them are not full-time Facebook employees. And so they have to just look at this policy manual and get guidance. And particularly if it's a new policy. So that's what Zuckerberg said. He kind of blamed it on a moderator. He said, well, they just didn't recognize it as a violent group.
Elizabeth, I mean, this actually just brings up a larger question. is it even possible for Facebook to catch every call to violence before it leads to tragedy in the real world? Is this a possibility? Is this a flaw in the function of how Facebook works?
I think in order to answer that question, we would need to really have a full accounting of what happened in Kenosha as a study, as a case study in what went wrong, and they would need to be open about it. My inclination is no, they, even when they announce a strong policy, they can't actually control these kinds of terms or calls to violence on their platform. It's just not realistic. And so instead of saying it's just not realistic, they're announcing policy after policy and they're failing. Facebook, with all of its resources, should be able to dedicate teams specifically to zero in on geographies mm-hmm. where there is social unrest and potential for violence and be proactive rather than depending on user reports only to flag it. And that's the question they haven't answered. Were they even proactive about this? I believe what is happening is while they don't give that full accounting to the public, Facebook's own employees are getting angrier and angrier and calling for Zuckerberg to explain this at town halls and publishing documents internally that get leaked. Mm-hmm. And that just shows that they're demanding accountability as well, saying, how can we work here when you say one thing, but you don't do it?
That's Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. As always, thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Tanya.
A dam blocking the middle fork of the Nooksack River in northern Washington will be removed this summer. The $18 million project is part of a nationwide effort to take down dams that have outlived their usefulness. Across the country, about 1,700 dams have been demolished in the past few decades to restore rivers and habitats. From member station KUOW, Eilish O'Neill reports this one will allow Chinook salmon and other fish to travel again up the river's reaches to spawn.
Yeah, this is a new dugout out of one piece of cedar.
George Swanisett Sr. is a 74-year-old member of the Nooksack tribe. He's showing off racing canoes he's built for himself and some of his kids and grandkids.
There is a bunch in here. I don't know what you call them. A fleet? This is my grandson's canoe. That's called Lone Star.
Swanisett says he grew up on the Nooksack River.
My first remembrance of the river, I was quite little. Mom and Dad were going down the river to do some dip netting, catch some fish. My dad introduced me to the water, picked me up and dropped me in the water and says, swim.
Swanisett says he's been on the river ever since.
It's our, how do you say, our bloodline that sustains us. We get our food from the river. We get our cultural healing from the river. We travel on the water.
Swanisett was 16 years old when the city of Bellingham dammed the river up in the foothills of the North Cascades mountain range to divert water for industry and homes. Ever since, Swanisett's been working to get the dam taken out. And now, it's finally happening. The dam is pretty small, as dams go. It's in a deep gorge with 100-foot canyon walls on either side of whitewater rapids. Contractors first had to divert the water to the side of the dam so they could blast the concrete structure. The city of Bellingham will still get some water from the river with a diversion mechanism that doesn't block the channel. Swanisett says he's concerned the city will take too much water out and the water that's left won't be cold enough for fish. April McEwen is overseeing the dam removal for the nonprofit American Rivers. She says Bellingham won't take too much water because the Nooksack's just a backup source.
Folks sort of pitch, you know, it's fish versus people or the environment versus people, and that doesn't have to be the case.
Dams are coming down all over the country, especially smaller dams like this one. The Nooksack Dam isn't needed anymore, and the only reason it didn't come down faster is money. It took more than $500,000 in private funding to kickstart the project, to pay for the designing and permitting so the shovel-ready project would qualify for state funds.
And so there's a lesson in that you can have your drinking water supply with much less environmental impact.
Far downriver from the dam, close to where the Nooksack River drains into Bellingham Bay, I meet Merle Jefferson. He's director of natural resources for the Lummi Nation. And he says this spot has changed a lot over the decades.
Yeah, this river used to be really, really, really deep.
Jefferson says he used to fish here full time, but there aren't enough fish left for that.
So this was a fishing village where I stayed as a small boy. And this is where my dad fished and my grandpa fished. So, you know, fishing is very, very important to Lummi Nation.
When the dam's gone, Steelhead and Spring Chinook will be able to migrate to spawning grounds upstream. Rich Carlson is with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says populations of threatened bull trout that live above and below the dam will be able to reunite.
The conditions of the upper watershed are very intact. It's undeveloped. It's a pretty good, clean water system, which is what bull trout need. They need clean, cold water.
Carlson says his agency will work with the Lummi and Nooksack to monitor how the fish are doing. As for George Swanisett Sr., the Nooksack canoe builder, he says he's just happy the river will run free again.
I just like going fishing. It's sitting down at the river, close to the water, listening to the, and close my eyes and imagining our people coming up the river and stuff like that.
He's looking forward to taking his grandkids and great-grandkids out on the water. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Northwest Washington State.
FEMA is being bombarded with calls for help after three natural disasters in this country within weeks of each other. There's the aftermath of last week's Hurricane Laura in Louisiana and Texas, fires in California, and then don't forget about the derecho in Iowa. People there feel many people have forgotten. This powerful windstorm, like a tornado without the spiral, hit about 3 weeks ago, and many Iowans are still unable to apply for individual federal assistance to repair their homes. Let's bring back Kate Payne, Eastern Iowa reporter for Iowa Public Radio. And Kate, when we spoke a couple weeks ago, you told us about people living outside in Cedar Rapids, because of the damage of the derecho there. Their apartments were, you know, devastated. It sounds like these people were able to relocate. So start there. Where are they?
Yes. So these families saw an outpouring of help, and many have been able to move into shelters, including at a local refugee support organization, which has been working very closely with them. Others have gone to hotels or are staying with family and friends. Some have entirely left the state. And refugee advocates are working with leaders in this particular community to really try and work on long-term solutions for long-term housing. That's going to be a real challenge for them to get people rehoused before winter.
You're telling us about people who were living in apartments and many of them refugees, but we've been hearing from listeners who are just average citizens, you know, living in homes who normally didn't have a lot of issues, and now they're confronted with so much loss. And many of them feel forgotten. What are you hearing?
Absolutely. So I think Midwesterners pride themselves on being self-reliant, but some of these people are really feeling that the state and federal government have failed them in this response, that it's just been insufficient. I talked with a city administrator of a small town of about 2,500 people last week, and he told me leaders literally flew over his county by helicopter that said that no state or federal officials had come to see the damage in his county. And again, when President Trump visited the state to see the damage, he visited Linn County, the highest population center, but he didn't leave the airport.
Well, so there's this sense, I mean, talk about flyover country. There's this sense that they've been forgotten. But President Trump did approve federal aid for public assistance to fix utilities and public buildings a couple weeks ago, but didn't approve individual assistance. Since then, we know residents in at least one county can apply. So what's been the response, and what's the sense of how much broader it needs to be?
Yeah. So initially, Governor Kim Reynolds requested federal assistance for 27 counties. So far, 16 have gotten that public assistance, so for rebuilding county buildings and for debris removal for those county governments. And again, only that one county, Linn County, the largest population center, has gotten individual assistance. And so for the rest of those counties, I mean, it's just, as one local official put it to me, this is a drop in the bucket for the federal government, but it could change these people's lives. You know, there are folks living in trailer parks with the trailers entirely knocked off their foundations. Some people are still living in really abhorrent conditions because they don't see other options. And especially in the rural part of the state, there's just very little support in these small communities.
Now, we'll talk more about the rural poor in Iowa. We talked on the program about how crops were devastated. I mean, just flattened, you know. And we heard from people saying, you know, we're more than corn. Mm-hmm. In addition to crops being flattened, which is no small thing in an agricultural mm-hmm. area, how are the rural poor doing?
Yeah, so as a local official put it to me, the farmers will be taken care of. You know, farmers have power in this state, even as they face so many challenges. But it's the rural poor, you know, who is taking care of them? Again, in some of these communities, there are a lot of older Iowans, retirees, who are living on very limited incomes, who have very specific health needs, like oxygen, insulin. And they say they just were not getting that support. I talked to an 83-year-old woman who took it upon herself to go door-to-door delivering food, this incredible woman. But who else would have done that if not for her in her community? And so you're seeing this incredible resilience of individuals. But the question is, where is the larger institutional support? And again, in these rural areas, there's fewer jobs. Everything is smaller scale. The mental health concerns are incredible because people are geographically isolated under so much pressure and not sure where to turn. We're also seeing incredible changes to the landscape with 100-year-old farmhouses destroyed. And so people are seeing this land that they love truly coming undone.
Oh, that could be so wounding, you know, just to see a barn mm-hmm. destroyed. And sure. I should add, that 83-year-old woman doing that noble work is doing it in the middle of a pandemic.
Yes.
Kate Payne, Eastern Iowa reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Thank you so much. Our thoughts are with the people there in Iowa. We're not going to forget the DeRate Show. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.